Robes and Robots is an AI digest of the day's judgments at SCOTUS, in which the robots use published opinions from the U.S. Supreme Court as their only source. The robots aren't lawyers, they're not even people, but they have read all the court papers you haven't, and here's what they have to say about them in 20 minutes or less.
Imagine this. A legal fight just explodes. It goes from a court motion, like right up to the Supreme Court in basically a day. A real race against time to stop people being, you know, removed from the U.S.
And under a law you almost never hear about.
Exactly. It sounds like fiction, but it actually happened in a very recent Supreme Court case.
And it really gets to a fundamental question, doesn't it? What basic legal protections, what we call due process, does someone get before the government can, well, kick them out? Especially when they say it's urgent, national security.
Right, the stakes couldn't be higher. So today we're doing a deep dive into that specific case. AARP, ETALV, Donald J. Trump, President of the United States, EPAL. It's number 24A1007.
It's all about the president using the Alien Enemies Act. This is against people alleged to be members of a group called Trendaragua, or TDA.
And we're going straight to the source for this. We've got the Supreme Court's own opinions, the main one, the per curiam decision.
That's the unsigned majority view?
Justice Kavanaugh's concurrence, where he agrees but adds his own points, and then a dissent from Justices Alito and Thomas.
Yeah, a strong dissent. So you get the full spectrum of views right from the court itself.
So our mission here is to unpack all of this for you. It's complex. It moved incredibly fast. Lots of procedural twists. We want you to really understand the arguments and see those different perspectives inside the court. Ready?
Let's do it.
Okay, so setting the scene. The president invokes this quite old law, the Alien Enemies Act.
Yeah, 50 U.S.C. Section 21, originally from like 1798, I think. It's done via a presidential proclamation, number 1903.
And the stated goal is removing Venezuelan nationals who are identified as members of this group, TDA.
And the people challenging this. Two named individuals, AARP and WMM, plus they're trying to represent a whole group, what the courts call a putative class.
Right. Others in the same boat, basically, held in Texas detention centers.
And they're asking the court, hey, stop these removals. They're saying it's summary removal happening way too fast without proper legal process under this AEA.
You said the stakes are immense. What does that mean practically?
Well, for the detainees, it means removal from the U.S., maybe indefinite detention somewhere else. The court itself said their interests are particularly weighty, you know, a big deal.
And the government side?
National security. They're saying it's critical to remove TDA members subject to the proclamation quickly. So urgency on both sides, really, but for very different reasons.
And that urgency just lights a fire under the whole legal process. The timeline is, well, it's something else.
It really is. It kicks off April 17th, 2025. The district court denies an initial request from the detainees for a TRO, a temporary restraining order.
Basically, please stop this immediately. And the court says no initially.
Right. Then, according to the detainees' filings, just hours later, people start getting served these AEA removal notices. And they're told removal could happen tonight or tomorrow.
Wow. Okay, so the clock is ticking. Loudly.
Very loudly. So April 18th, 12.34 a.m. Central Time, middle of the night, they file a new emergency TRO motion with that same district court.
They try again, emphasizing the emergency.
Exactly. Hours go by, nothing happens. They need a decision now. So at 12.48 p.m. that same day, they tell the court, basically, we need a ruling by 1.30 p.m.
Giving the judge 42 minutes.
42 minutes. On an emergency motion involving constitutional rights and national security claims, it's an extremely tight deadline.
And when 1.30 p.m. comes and goes with no ruling,
they don't wait. At 3.02 p.m., just about 2 hours after setting that deadline, they file an appeal up to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals.
Saying what? That the district court denied it?
Sort of. They argue the court's failure to act so quickly, its inaction, was effectively a denial. They called it a constructive denial.
Yeah.
Given the urgency, silence was refusal, in their view.
Okay, but then things get even messier, right? There's another court involved.
Yeah, this is a key point the Supreme Court later picks up on. That same evening, April 18th, there's a totally separate hearing in a different case about AEA removals, but this one's in a D.C. court. And in that hearing, the government lawyer tells the D.C. judge that no members of the Texas class, the group we're talking about, would be removed that day, April 18th.
Oh, so a pause.
A temporary one. Critically, the government lawyer immediately added they reserve the right to remove them the very next day, April 19th. And they actually stated they thought that timeline was consistent with due process.
Even though people were told tonight or tomorrow?
Right. And what came out later, presented to the Supreme Court, was evidence suggesting the government had actually started moving people on April 18th, transporting detainees, getting them ready. So that threat of removal felt very, very real to the people involved.
So everything's converging. The potential April 19th removal deadline is looming.
People might already be on buses.
And then just before midnight Central Time on the 18th, so it's already early morning, April 19th on the East Coast where the Supreme Court is.
12.52 a.m. Eastern.
Yeah. The Supreme Court steps in. They issue an order.
And it's a big one. They prohibit the government from removing any member of that putative class.
Why?
To preserve their own ability, their jurisdiction, to even hear the case properly. They needed to stop the removals to keep the case alive, essentially.
And what about the Fifth Circuit appeal that the detainees filed?
Well, while the Supreme Court was doing that, the Fifth Circuit actually ruled. They dismissed the detainees' appeal.
Why?
Lack of jurisdiction. They seem to have focused on that 42-minute deadline, basically saying the detainees hadn't given the district court a reasonable amount of time to act before appealing.
Okay, so the Fifth Circuit says no jurisdiction, but the Supreme Court has already stepped in and paused things. So now the whole mess lands squarely at the Supreme Court. What's the main outcome from their per curiam opinion?
The headline is, the Supreme Court disagrees with the Fifth Circuit, keeps the pause on removals in place, and sends the case back down.
So they grant the injunction.
Yes, temporarily. They block the government from using the AEA to remove the named plaintiffs or anyone in that putative class while the case goes back through the lower courts. And to do that, technically, they treat the emergency application as a petition for certiorari, a request for review. They grant that, they wipe out, vacate, the Fifth Circuit's dismissal, and they remand it, send it back to the Fifth Circuit for a proper look.
Okay, so how did they justify disagreeing with the Fifth Circuit on jurisdiction? That seems like a big hurdle.
It is. And they leaned on the idea that appeals courts can review these mid-case orders, interlocutory orders, if they have the practical effect of refusing an injunction.
So inaction can be action, basically.
In urgent situations, yes. They said when there's a high risk of serious, perhaps irreparable harm, a district court just not ruling for a significant period can be treated as denying the injunction. They even cited a major legal guidebook, Wright and Miller, on this.
And they didn't buy the 42-minute argument.
No, they looked at the bigger picture. They calculated the inaction period not as 42 minutes, but as 14 hours and 28 minutes from when the emergency motion was filed until the appeal was lodged. Given the detainees were facing, in the court's words, an imminent threat of severe irreparable harm, that length of inaction did have the practical effect of a denial.
Did they have more information than the Fifth Circuit?
It seems so, or at least they weighed it differently. They specifically mentioned having information the Fifth Circuit might not have focused on, like those government statements in the D.C. court about reserving the right to remove after midnight and the evidence that emerged about detainees already being transported on the 18th.
So jurisdiction, check. They found a way. What about the core issue? Due process. What notice are people owed under this AEA?
Right. Here they drew on pretty settled principles. First, the Fifth Amendment applies. Aliens get due process in removal proceedings. They cited their own recent case, Trump v. GGG, for that.
Okay. And due process means notice.
It requires notice that's reasonably calculated to tell someone what's happening and give them a reasonable time to respond. That's classic Mullane standard.
How does that apply to the Alien Enemies Act specifically?
They look back at older cases like the Japanese immigrant case.
Yeah.
And also that recent JGG decision. They concluded AEA detainees have to get notice that they're being targeted under the AEA, and that notice needs to come in a reasonable time and manner so they can actually seek habeas relief before getting removed.
Actually seek habeas relief? What does that entail?
Well, habeas corpus is the legal way to challenge your detention or removal. So the court said the notice has to give someone enough time and information so they can reasonably contact a lawyer, file the necessary court documents, the habeas petition, and actually try to get relief from the court.
And the notice given here, the roughly 24 hours, maybe less, with removals possibly starting tonight?
The court was pretty blunt about that. They said notice roughly 24 hours before removal, devoid of information about how to exercise due process rights to contest that removal, surely does not pass muster.
Surely does not pass muster. That's clear.
Very clear. But, And this is important. They didn't say exactly what notice is required.
Okay. So they didn't set a new rule like you need 72 hours or anything?
Nope. They explicitly said they were not deciding the precise constitutional minimum for all AEA removals. That question, what is adequate notice here? They sent back down to the Fifth Circuit to figure out first.
So the ruling was just, whatever happened on April 18th wasn't enough. And the injunction keeps things paused while the lower court decides what is enough.
Exactly. The injunction preserves the status quo, preserves their jurisdiction, while that crucial question gets addressed.
Okay. Now, what about this class action aspect? Giving relief to the whole group, the putative class, not just the two named people. That seemed controversial, too, especially since the district court apparently denied class certification later on.
Right. The dissent really jumps on that later denial. But the Supreme Court majority, acting before that denial, said courts can issue temporary relief, like this injunction, for a putative class. A potential class that isn't certified yet specifically to preserve the court's jurisdiction while things get sorted out on appeal. Again, they cited legal treatises for support.
And they didn't like the idea that the government could sort of pick off the named plaintiffs to kill the class action.
Yeah, they were skeptical of that. They said the government couldn't necessarily defeat class treatment just by promising the named individuals they wouldn't be removed as a matter of grace. They compared it to situations where a defendant stops the challenged behavior just to make a lawsuit go away, something courts frowned upon.
And they also pushed back on a kind of circular argument.
Exactly. They called it a self-defeating notion. This idea that the only way to fight for the right to get notice needed for habeas relief is through individual habeas petitions filed by people who, by definition, haven't received that adequate notice yet. How can you file if you don't have the proper notice to do so?
It's a catch-22.
Pretty much. And they noted that the district court's later denial of class certification seemed more focused on the underlying challenges to whether the AEA could be used at all on a class basis, rather than the threshold issue of just getting enough notice to start a case.
So the instructions going back down the remand instructions for the Fifth Circuit are?
Two main things. First, for the named plaintiffs, ARP and WMM, the Fifth Circuit needs to look at their underlying challenge to using the AEA against them and apply the standard factors for a preliminary injunction. Second, for the putative class, the Fifth Circuit needs to figure out what kind of notice actually satisfies due process in this context.
And they want it done quickly.
Yes. They added a final note urging lower courts to handle these AEA cases expeditiously.
Okay, that's the majority view. But Justice Kavanaugh agreed with the outcome of the injunction, but wrote separately.
Right, a concurrence. He agreed the injunction was necessary. For him, the key was ensuring the courts could actually review the legality of the removals before they happened. Judicial review was paramount.
Did he highlight the main questions still needing answers?
Yes. He zeroed in on two big ones. First, does this old Alien Enemies Act even authorize removing these alleged TDA members? Second, if it does, what specific notice and process does the Constitution require before you do it?
And he noted that courts are already disagreeing on this.
Yeah, he pointed out that different federal district courts were already reaching conflicting conclusions on these very issues, that inconsistency signals a need for clarity.
He also mentioned the urgency felt by everyone involved.
Absolutely. He highlighted that both sides saw it as urgent the government for national security, needing speed, and the detainees who were asking the Supreme Court itself to step in quickly and even grant review before a final judgment below.
So what was his preference then?
Given that urgency from all sides and the importance of the unresolved legal questions, he actually said he would have preferred the Supreme Court just decide those big substantive issues right then and there rather than sending it back down. He felt that would be more consistent with everyone's call for speed.
Okay, makes sense. Now for the fireworks, the dissent. Justice Alito, joined by Justice Thomas, they disagreed strongly.
Fundamentally disagreed. Their starting point was blunt. No jurisdiction. The court shouldn't have touched this case yet.
Why no jurisdiction? They didn't buy the constructive denial argument.
Not at all. They argued the district court judge was acting reasonably and diligently. Complex issues, emergency filings. The judge wasn't being inactive, in their view. That 42-minute deadline the detainees set, they called it an extraordinary demand, a stark departure from normal practice. They felt the judge was being rushed unfairly.
And they viewed the facts differently from the majority, especially what the district court knew at the time.
Exactly. They emphasized what was actually before the district court judge on April 18th when the appeal happened. For the named plaintiffs, they said there was no imminent danger because the government had promised not to remove them while their other cases were pending.
Okay, and for the rest of the class?
They called the evidence for imminent removal of the class members sketchy, pointed to one piece as double hearsay. They strongly criticized the majority for relying on information that came out later, like the D.C. court hearing statements or evidence submitted days after the appeal, to judge whether the district court's earlier inaction was unreasonable. Hindsight bias, essentially.
So jurisdiction was their first big disagreement. What else?
Second major point. Even if there was jurisdiction, the detainees didn't meet the tough requirements for getting an injunction anyway, especially not for the whole class.
Why not?
They had serious doubts whether class actions are even proper in habeas corpus cases at all. They argued there's little historical basis for it, and habeas is usually about very individual detention issues, not group claims. They questioned readings of cases like Harris v. Nelson that allow multi-party habeas.
And even if class actions could theoretically be used,
they said the applicants hadn't shown they were likely to meet the specific requirements for class certification. A key one is typicality. Are the named plaintiffs' claims typical of the class? The dissent said no. Why? Because the named plaintiffs already had pending habeas cases and that government promised not to remove them. They didn't need the same kind of emergency notice relief the rest of the class was seeking. Their situation was different.
What about the majority's point about the government trying to defeat the class action by making promises?
The dissent pushed back. They said the promise wasn't some special grace for these two. It reflected a general government policy regarding people with pending habeas petitions. Not a tactic, just policy.
And they really leaned on that later district court decision, right? The one that actually denied class certification.
Heavily. They stressed that on May 9th, after a rigorous analysis, the district court did deny class certification for both the AEA validity claims and the notice claims. The district court found, citing Jennings v. Rodriguez, that due process and notice rights are inherently individual. The dissent felt the Supreme Court majority just brushed aside this detailed later analysis from the trial judge.
Okay, jurisdiction, injunction standards. Any other major points from the dissent?
Yes, one more big one. They disagreed strongly with the court granting certiorari before judgment.
Meaning taking the case directly from the Fifth Circuit's dismissal before any court really ruled on the merits.
Exactly. They called this a sharp departure from the court's usual role as a court of review, not first view. They felt the court was jumping in too early, deciding things before the lower courts had a chance to fully develop the record and rule on the substance. They even suggested it looked far too much like an expansion of our original jurisdiction, almost like the Supreme Court was acting like a trial court.
Wow. Okay, so we've got the frantic timeline, the majority stepping in based on urgency and due process concerns, Kavanaugh wanting faster answers, and the dissent saying, whoa, hold on, you don't even have the power to do this yet, and the whole class action thing is wrong. How do we tie this all together for someone listening?
Well, it really throws into sharp relief that constant tension, right? National security versus individual rights.
Yeah.
How do you balance the government's need for speed, especially when they invoke security, against the fundamental constitutional requirement to give someone fair notice and a chance to be heard before you take serious action against them?
And the case shows just how complex and messy these things can get procedurally. A few hours, a missed deadline, different courts hearing related things. It all cascades incredibly quickly.
Absolutely. And what's maybe most striking is seeing the highest court in the land disagreeing so fundamentally on basic things. Not just, you know, how to interpret the AEA, but whether they even had jurisdiction to act. Whether class actions, a standard tool in many areas of law, even apply here. It shows these aren't always easy, settled questions, even for the justices.
Getting these different perspectives directly from their opinions really gives you a much richer picture than just knowing the outcome.
Definitely. You see the legal reasoning, the different ways they weigh the facts, the underlying judicial philosophies at play.
So where does this leave things now? The immediate result?
The immediate result is a pause. The Supreme Court stopped these specific AEA removals for this group. The case goes back to the Fifth Circuit. That court now has to tackle two big jobs. Figure out what is constitutionally adequate notice for the putative class in this AEA context, and also evaluate the underlying legality of using the AEA against the named plaintiffs, considering the factors for a preliminary injunction.
So the fight's far from over.
Not even close. And it leaves us and you listening with a really profound question to think about. When the government pulls out a law like the Alien Enemies Act, aiming for swift removal and citing national security, What level of notice, what kind of opportunity to be heard does the Constitution absolutely demand? How are the lower courts going to draw that line now, trying to balance those competing pressures the government's security claims versus the due process rights the Supreme Court clearly said must be protected? It's a critical question, and this case puts it front and center.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Robes and Robots. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and visit us at robesandrobots.com.